Accession number 20525, Reel 2.
Okay, you're on.
Yes, I must just tell you a final thing about the Advanced Flyers School. Of course, low flying was quite important, and the last trip we did was a solo cross country where we flew down to the Gulf and along the Gulf and then back up across. Well, of course, there's an awful lot of forest
down
there.
The Gulf of Mexico.
Gulf of Mexico, yeah. There's an awful lot of pine. Oh dear, sorry.
Right.
An awful lot of pine forests you fly across. Well, of course, no fly. That wasn't that a marvellous excuse to enjoy ourselves. So we get down to the Gulf, and there are a whole lot of us all flag along, and we were going along and shooting up the shrimping boats, and we were talking to one another over the radio and so on, and having a whale of a time. And eventually, we had to pick up the entrance of the Suwannee River to go northbound back to Valdosta. And we didn't realise that we were being picked up by one of the American Air Force stations down there.
What, your radio conversation?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they'd told our base, and so they sent down flying instructors to pick us up on the way back. And of course we were way down low on the top of the trees, and every so often there'd be a fire tower with a fire warden up there, and he was passing the reports through, and eventually most of us had an instructor formating our wing, you see, went right back to base. When we got there, we were hustled out, and we were taken over by the instructors, and we were hazed. Well, now, my co-pilot was this chap, Leroy Doughty, who was a lieutenant, and so they had us, and they didn't have hazes. They took him to one side and gave him a right dressing down, but they had the rest of us, Americans and British, and they gave us a regular hazing. And the hazing was to, they say, they give us a little talk quietly, and then suddenly they say, freeze. And there'd be two or three of the instructors standing around you. And when you froze, you had to stand rigidly at attention, every muscle in your body taut. And they come on and say, come on, freeze, freeze. And they literally bully you, see, until you were so taut, you were absolutely shivering, you see. And this went on for quite a while. And then they said, right, okay, don't be caught again. Don't be caught again. Off we went. That was the end of it, you see. Old Doughty, of course, he just had a talking down. Well, that you see, if we'd been caught doing that before, we'd have been sent back to Canada. We'd have been pushed off the course. But we'd done all our training. It was just the final passing out one, so they let us get away with it.
They'd spend all that money on you.
That's right.
To throw you off the course.
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
So, and anyway, I think they...
But, I mean, that cross-country flying was meant to be done at low level, wasn't it?
Or 500...
You went.
500 feet. We're supposed to be down clipping the tops of the shrimping boats. I don't think we were the first to do that sort of thing.
So, now, you're back in England, and what was your first posting?
I went to a training school in Herefordshire, and we were taking up pupils, and they were practicing down the back, and we were in, either we'd take them up in a thing called a Proctor, which was just a single engine aeroplane with room for one passenger, and or in a Domini, which was, of course, the DH 89 twin engine DH biplane, and we'd take them up with an instructor, and they would practice down the back.
What were they doing? Navigating?
Navigating and radio operating mainly, practicing the radio.
So you were a staff pilot
then? I was a staff pilot then, mm-hmm. Yes. So we did fantastic number of hours doing that. And that once again, I found that very enjoyable because we had a job to do, and we got on and did it. And there were a crowd of us, all sergeant pilots, with one or two officers who, for various reasons, they'd been ill and they couldn't go straight back on operations, and so they came to do this sort of work. And we'd be down on the flight lines at 8 o'clock in the morning with the airborne by 8:30, and we'd come down for lunch and off again, and we'd finish about 5:30, day after day after day. And we'd just have one day off a week. We'd fly right through Sunday and so on. And, did we get a day off? We didn't get any days off, that's right. It was only when the weather was bad we had a day off. We just kept flying. But we used to get leave every 6 weeks, so that was a good thing. And we didn't half fly hard. And
now, you were young sergeants, or most of you were young 21-year-olds.
Oh, yes, all young. No, there were some older ones. I mean, one of my friends, old Page, he was about 27 and he had 3 children. And very sad, he killed himself, didn't he? Not there, he went on, you know, on bombers, he didn't come back. But no, there were one or two older ones, but and there was a mixture of English and Scottish, of course, and so on. And we had a couple of Frenchmen, we had the odd New Zealander, and it's quite interesting, really.
How did you get on with the in the mess with the old sweats?
Oh, we lived our own life. Yeah. I mean, we were all unto ourselves. We never wore our hats. We were all issued with bicycles. As soon as we finished flying, we'd rush back to the mess and have some food, and then we'd go back and have a wash and a scrub up, or vice versa. And we're down to the Red Lion in Madley, and all the WAFs, and, the WAFs of our type were there, and we'd have a rare old night. There was a strange trace of it. I often think about it now. There was very little sex. I mean, all this business about sex. Very little, really. We were so busy having a marvellous time, and we had to go back to bed early because we were up early in the morning, and we had a whale of a time, really. And of course, there were all these pupils there with the discipline, heavy discipline, and we were a bad example. But the station warrant officer, a chap called Lord, he was a very good warrant officer, actually, but he had a thing, and he and his flight sergeant, they had a thing about the sergeant pilots, and they'd set traps for us, and they'd then try and get us on a fizz, and we'd go before the chief flying instructor, and they'd say, "Naughty boys, you shouldn't tease him, you know, he's gone." Because obviously they weren't going to do anything with us, were they? Because we were working as hard as anybody on the station. And, you know, strange to relate, many, many years later, I was flying Dakotas down Africa, down to through Africa, and I was sent to Khartoum to pick up an RAF detachment. And when I get there, of course, in charge of it was Warrant Officer Lord, still a warrant officer, and also I had 3 thick stripes on my arm. And he recognised me, and I recognised him. We both burst out laughing. But he was a bit of a devil, really. But no, we worked very hard. We really did work hard there. And I think we gave them our money's worth. And certainly, from my point of view, it was a wonderful experience because, as I say, once I got on to the real stuff. I flying was just, I didn't have to think about it.
What aerodrome was this in Hereford?
Madley.
Oh, Madley.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how long were you there?
I was there about 9 months, I suppose. Yes. I think, yes, it was about 9 months. Maybe a bit less, I don't know. Can't remember now. If I had my logbooks, I could tell you. I wish I had them, but I haven't at the moment. But so that was jolly good. And
so what was your next posting?
Well, I went to what do they call it now? Flying school, anyway. Back to a place called Wing, training on Wellingtons, and then from there we went on to a conversion unit onto Stirlings, and so on.
So Wing, that was an OCU, was it?
Yes, OTU, that's what I was trying to think of, yes.
Wellingtons, were they?
There were threes.
Threes, were they?
Yeah. Mm.
And were you destined for Bomber Command at that point?
Oh, yes.
You were?
I'd tried very hard. Of course, they'd said to me that if I went on this staff piloting, I would go on a course to go on Coastal Command. We had to do a GR course, General Reconnaissance course, to go on Coastal Command. Well, you see, if I'd trained in Canada, I could have gone on a GR course in Canada and come back, and I'd have been all right. But I could then have gone on to a GR course and gone on to Coastal. Unfortunately for me, but fortunately for the war efforts, we'd more or less conquered the U-boat then, and they had taken a lot of bomber crews to put on Coastal in connection with the U-boat, and so they didn't need any more people on Coastal.
Coastal Command Wellingtons, were they?
Well, of course, various Coastal. I mean, if you went on Coastal, whether you went on Wellingtons or Beaufort, Sunderland, anything like that. Because I always thought I'd like to go on a Sunderland, but there are very few people. And in retrospect, it was the best thing I ever did, was to go on, seeing that I managed to get through. Because if I'd gone on Sunderland, I'd have ended up by being a co-pilot and, you know, a bit dreary. I didn't realise that before. But or else I'd have ended up on Wellingtons, Lee Light Wellingtons, or something like that. But
how did you like the Wellington? Was it easy to convert onto?
Oh, I loved the Wellington. It was a marvellous aeroplane. The only thing was that the equipment we had was a bit clapped out, and for instance, it had an automatic device to centre it to neutralise your trim, and series of bell cranks and levers and wires, and as it was in use for training, sometimes it wasn't operated properly, so it got strained, so it wouldn't work properly, so sometimes it would catch you out. There's things like that. But I later flew fully operational Wellingtons, and it was a very fine aeroplane, there's no doubt about
it. What did you like
about it? It was good handling, very good handling, and
it did what it was told quickly.
That's right. It was a nice aeroplane to handle. Mm. Yes, it was a very nice aeroplane to handle. And so long afterwards, and my memory really is not of the OTU Wellington. It's of the later one, the Mark 10, the fully operational Mark 10, which we had new aeroplanes when I was on those. Which was a very nice aeroplane, and I went on that from Stirlings and Lancasters, and it was a very nice aeroplane to fly. And of course, it had that. You could get up to 20,000 feet quite happily with that aeroplane. Very nice aeroplane to fly.
That was in Bomber Command you flew that, was it?
Okay. I flew that in a special, the operational one. Mm. I flew that with Sixth Group, the radar group. I'm not quite sure which command that came under.
Anyhow, we'll possibly come on to that.
Yeah,
because you went from the Wellington OCU onto Stirlings.
Onto Stirlings, yes.
Yeah.
And once again, I enjoyed the Stirling because it was a very nice aeroplane to fly once you got it off the ground and until you were getting it back on the ground. And there was a special technique because to handle it landing and take off because of the long pod undercarriage, because if you remember the Stirling was the bomber version of the Sunderland, and the Sunderland wings had to be chopped down to go into the standard issue RAF hangar. And it was a very sophisticated, the building of it was very sophisticated. I mean, it weighed 72,000, whereas the Lancaster was 68 with a full bomb load, 72,000. Yet the bomb load was less, so the weight of the aircraft was quite heavy, and it looked as though it was built. It was built like a, you know, and
it was an enormous aeroplane, wasn't it?
Oh, it was, yeah, and it used to stick up there,
yeah.
And the Halifax and the Lancaster and the Stirling had just simple control levers through wires to the various surfaces and so on. The Stirling, the throttles, had a hydraulic system, and quite sophisticated, really. And the steering, instead of with the Lancaster steering, if I remember right,
on the ground.
Yes, on the ground. You did it on the foot pedals, but on the Stirling, you just had ordinary foot pedals. But your brake was a lever at the side, a great enormous big yellow painted lever, which you had to work at the same time as using all things, but feet. But so that high undercarriage gave problems on landing. If you had a crosswind and you misjudged it, you could easily shear your undercarriage off. Or if you overcorrected, you'd go wobbling down and the undercarriage would shear off. That was quite common. So you had to be right with your landing. It was really good training to do it.
Why was it such a high off the ground aeroplane? Because it didn't make the armourer's job any easier, did it?
Well, it was a tailwheel undercarriage, and it was a function of the wing, really.
Mm.
This chopped off wing. Yeah.
But why did it still have, I don't understand why it was chopped off wings. It still had to be so high off the ground.
I can't give you an accurate answer. I just imagine it was that. And also, of course, the wing loading would be higher than the. Yes, so the speeds were higher. Your takeoff speeds were higher than the other two aeroplanes. I imagine that's what it was. And I mean, you've got to lose all your lift, haven't you?
Mm.
And I haven't
getting
thought
it off
about
the
these
ground,
things for a
fully
long
loaded.
Time.
I mean, you said, I mean, it was a high wing loading thing. So if you've got a full bomb load, getting it off the ground probably takes an awful lot of space, doesn't it?
Oh, it did on the Stirling, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, you had to be right. And also, having got it in the air, it took an awful long time to build up speed. So you take a long time going down the runway, and you eventually pull it off. And with the modern aeroplanes, you have certain speeds, and your co-pilot calls these speeds, V1, V2, rotate, you see. But with those, you just did it purely by feel. And if you got the tailwheel up too early, you were wasting space because you were, you know, to hold it up there, you had to have extra control surfaces, which were wasting speed in a sense. So you had to go along on your tailwheel for a while, and it would gradually come up. And then you'd start pulling back the stick slightly, and not too much, just pull it back slightly until it literally lifted off slowly, which took up a lot of runway. Having got it off, then it took a long time for the speed, this was a full bomb load, for the speed to build up. And if you lost an engine at that stage, it was pretty horrific. I remember at that time I was based at Woolfox Lodge in Rutlandshire, as it was then.
Woolfox Lodge?
Yeah, which was right by the Great North Runway, the A4. And A1. A1.
Mm.
And we take off towards the... towards the town, and sometimes we go over the top of the town about 700 feet, because you just couldn't. You had to get the speed. You had to keep it down. If you lost an engine, then it was really quite horrific. So that was the problem with the Stirling, and the same with landing. If you were landing with a crosswind and you misjudged it, you could wipe the undercarriage, which happened. I remember people doing that. But you see, with a Lancaster and a Halifax, they were completely different kettle of fish. Once you got it in the air, the Stirling, every slightest movement of your wheel would dip the wing slightly. You had absolute control, whereas the Lancaster was the opposite. With the Lancaster, if you wanted the wing to drop, you had to put the stick right over, and the wing would sort of flop down. And then and as it was getting somewhere near where you wanted it, you would then lift the stick. Mm-hmm. But with the Stirling, it was inching all the time. It was beautiful control. Yes, it was a nice aeroplane to fly, except it had these basic problems of takeoff and landing and altitude as a bomber.
The crew layout, I mean, the pilot and co-pilot, they sat under this sort of glass canopy, didn't they? on their own?
We didn't have a co-pilot.
You didn't?
No. A bomb aimer acted as co-pilot.
Oh, really?
And on the Stirling, yes, let me think now. The engineer was down the back, so it was the bomb aimer was your co-pilot. And so he never had any flying training, so we used to give him a little bit, you see, because obviously sometimes he might need it.
Yeah.
So we'd give him some handling practice. And
there's a friend of mine flew Stirlings with 7th Squadron. And,
oh, yes.
And he was shot up on that raid over Brest.
Oh, yes.
In December 41. And he was flying as a co-pilot then. So.
Yeah.
But you carried about a crew of 6, didn't you, on... front and rear gunner.
Pilot, navigator, bomb aimer, radio operator, front and rear gunner 6, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yes, well, initially, of course, they were co-pilots. Mm-hmm. And with Coast Command, of course, they had co-pilots too. But Bomber Command, they were getting very short of pilots. And so they started running them with just the one pilot.
This was in 1944 when you joined, was it 218?
Oh, I think it was before that.
Was it? Yeah.
Yeah, it was before that.
Was it 218 Squadron?
218 Squadron, yeah. I was with, yes.
So, but, I mean, what did you actually go on bombing operations with on the Stirling?
No. Mining and special duties, you know.
Mm.
No.
What was that, dropping supplies?
Spy to the Maquis,
yeah.
And, and to the Kattegat. And
mine laying
and down to Brest. And
how was mine laying down? Pretty low level, was it?
Well, yes, we did it from about 6,000 feet.
Oh, from that high?
Oh, yes.
And the mine wouldn't be damaged when it hit the water?
No, you mustn't be above that. And you mustn't be too low either. You had to be pretty accurate with your height.
Did you parachute them down then? Or did you just...
I can't remember now.
Free-fall?
I think they were free-falled. Mm. Free-fell, yes.
They hit the sea, didn't they?
Yeah, do you know, I remember going into Brest, mining in the approaches to Brest, and it was one of a very early flight I did, and I remember my engineer was a little bit nervous, a very nice chap, but he was a little bit nervous, and he was down the back with the radio operator, and the navigator too, and the... navigator's astrodome was just above, and so while he was the navigator and the he used to obviously was occupied working the G radar system, going up an accurate course, and the engineer at this stage was just up in the astrodome watching. And so as we came into the estuary, of course they had Bofors guns on either side. Bofors guns, every umpteenth one is a tracer shell, so you can see them coming up. And of course, I used to always wind my seat right down low and do what I was told to do, you see. I just sort of watched my instruments and flying by instruments, and just I had enough people on board to tell me what was happening outside. So I was down there, and suddenly I heard this bit of a kerfuffle down the back, and apparently. The engineer came down and he was dancing up and down, you see. So the radio operator said, "What are you doing that for?" He says, "The flak outside, you know, if you keep moving, there's less chance of being hit." But I remember that. I can remember going through there about 6,000 feet. That's when it was happening, which was, of course, Bofors gun height.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What other operations did you go on with the Stirling?
Because
it was a glider tug as well, wasn't it?
No, I didn't do that.
No.
One, no. Some of 149, which was one of the last Stirling squadrons, half of them went to form another squadron, which it was a glider towing squadron, and half stayed on Bomber Command, and converted when we did onto Lancs. No, my bombing was basically done on Lancasters. And I didn't do any mining on Lancaster at all. It's all bombing.
You went over dropping window, didn't you, on one operation you were telling me about?
Oh, no. I just joined the squadron, and some of the people already on the squadron did that. And
that was just before D-Day to mislead the
It was German the night of D-Day, the 6th, wasn't it? 6th of June.
Yeah, 5th
of June.
6th was the actual day, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was the night of the 5th then, 5th or 6th. No, I didn't do that. They sent me on leave, so I'll keep my mouth shut. And came back, and then we trained on a thing called GH, which was a refinement of the G system, whereby you're familiar with the G system,
yeah,
are you?
Yeah, but I mean, perhaps it's an idea to just...
Well, the G system, you have a system of radio stations all linked, say three or four linked. One of them is a master station, and the slaves, it's picked up on the radar set by the navigator as a blip, and the blip is an indication of the time it takes for the signal to be transmitted from the master station to the slave and then to go back again, or vice versa. I can't remember now. And you take the readings, and on your chart you have a series of hyperbolic lines over the area you're flying, and the navigator takes these a series of readings off his thing and plots and takes a number and picks that number up on the chart on a particular hyperbole, and then he obviously can't do them all at once, but he just transfers them according to his dead reckoning to cross at one point. That point is the your position at that time. And that was the main navigation aid over the UK and the near continent. But of course it was jammed, so there were problems there, but always around that. And that's what I did when I left my bomber command. I went to 60 Group to sort out that sort of problem with the scientists. But the GH, there was another system called BABS, where the aircraft sent a signal to a ground station and it was reflected back to you. And on your radar set, you had a blip, which indicated the distance you were from the ground station. And this was, initially, it was supposed to be for giving your distance out from the runway using the other instrument landing system. But anyway, they adapted it so that this was done at VHF frequencies, and they adapted it so that your navigator would direct you to fly down one of these hyperbole lines which ran through your bomb aiming position, and he would also pick up distances which, so at a certain distance you were at a certain position over the ground, and that's when the bomb aimer dropped his bombs, you see, to hit the target.
This is GH.
Mm. Yes. Mm. So it was a particularly accurate navigation, particularly accurate system. Mm. It was used later in mapping all over the world. They had
the DECA system, wasn't it? The DECA navigator system.
No. This was GH. It was used GH. By Ordnance Survey.
Was it?
Oh yes. Yeah. It was very accurate. For instance, I remember it was not unusual to get all your practice bombs within 80 yards of your target using TH. Well, of course, we did an awful lot of practice. And to do that was fantastic. So it was very useful for bombing synthetic oil plants or marshalling yards or any target which you wanted great accuracy. And so that was the 218 Squadron's speciality. And we were all very highly trained, our navigators and the pilots. We worked together on a synthetic trainer. And the way it worked was that you'd navigate to a certain point, and pretty near the hyperbolic line, and then the navigator would then, at that point, he would tell you to pick up a certain course until you actually hit the line, and he'd give you a course to fly then, and then as you drifted off, initially the course corrections would be giving a course, but as you got nearer and nearer to your dropping position, of course, it was a very minute change. So he'd say S-turn port, S-turn stop, and S-turn was just dipping your wing and back up again, you see, which would just inch you over slightly. And all the time he was lining up these two blips of the BAB side of it, and then he actually pressed the button to drop the bombs. Bomb Aimer was just co-piloting at this stage, but it was very, very accurate, and we specialised in that.